Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help us explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, JewishSacredAging.com, and the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. And we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com. And if you wish, if you go to the homepage of Jewish Sacred Aging, you can leave a voicemail message, and we invite you to do so. And we welcome to this edition of the Seekers of Meaning podcast, Bruce Frankel, who is a partner in Red String, which is a digital community builder of technology and co-president of the Life Planning Network of New England, and Paul Nagel, the executive director of Stonewall Community Development. And we're going to talk about something that we alluded to in a podcast about a year ago, and that is the development of a village program, and we're going to get into that, in New York, specifically aimed at the LGBTQ population, which is something that is slowly, I think, starting to getting some traction around the country. So, Bruce and Paul, welcome to Seekers of Meaning. How you doing?
Good. Good to be with you, Rabbi.
You can use Richard. We've known each other, Bruce, for a while, so it's that formal we're not yet. Anyway, so the Stonewall Village, New York City, creating an intergenerational digital LGBTQ community. Talk to me about what this is really. What is the Stonewall Village community? And it's modeled after the National Village Communities, if I'm not mistaken. And if I am, you'll correct me. What is this Stonewall Village?
Hi, it's Paul here. You are correct. It's modeled after the National Villages, with a couple of key differences, one being that we're not geographic, except that it's all five boroughs of New York City. Most of the villages are very geographically contained in a small neighborhood. We also are LGBTQ focused. I think we're the only one in the country that is. And also, most of them charge $500 to $700 a year membership, and we are charging $20 or nothing.
Mm-hmm. So the two of you, Paul, you're in New York, if I'm not mistaken, and yes. Bruce is based in Massachusetts.
That's correct.
Bruce has written some stuff on older adult issues, the book What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? The Red String community, the technology community. What brought the two of you together? You just didn't meet on a train, I would assume, or at the ballpark. How did you get together to do this? What was the genesis of this idea?
Well, actually, a member, this is Bruce, a member of the Stonewall CDC knows someone named Joy Laverty, who I think you're familiar with, who's written a book on who will take care of me when I'm old, or mm-hmm. when I'm old. And Joy, who's in Chicago, to throw the geography out there a bit further, is a friend of mine. And she knew that Stonewall was going to try to make a non-geographic located village. And she heard the platform that they were thinking of using, and she said, why don't you talk to Bruce and see whether his platform will work better for you. So we ended up starting conversations about 14 months ago. We began planning, and we've been working at creating this online village, digital community experience that is turning out to be awesome. And you know, so that's how we met. That's the genesis of it. And it's been Paul and Saif LaShaw, who's his program director, have been incredible partners in all of this. And the growing community around Stonewall CDC has been amazing, as evidenced last night by an amazing fundraiser that we had in downtown Manhattan.
So for people who may not be aware, just talk to me a little bit about the significance of the word Stonewall.
Sure. So it's, you know, the Stonewall riots. A lot of the activists who created this organization are members of the Stonewall Democratic Club. And the significance really is that a lot of the folks who are 65 plus now, who were the leaders of the revolution, are going back in the closet out of fear of discrimination and abuse in the elder services industry. And we actually formed around an event where a friend of ours who had had a stroke and was immobilized in a nursing home, an aide decided to scrub the devil out of her vagina and gave her an infection that killed her. And that was the catalyst for us organizing. So Stonewall is deeply embedded in the DNA of what we're doing. And a lot of what we're doing is community organizing, because we need to affect some policy change if we're going to be able to pull this off, creating LGBT senior friendly housing. So, and that is part of the reason that we were led to registering, because we just didn't find the village community technology interactive enough for what we wanted to do.
So just walk me through again the concept of the electronic village, as opposed to, because we've had people who have developed villages on podcasts before, and you're right, it's a geographic area and you pay a membership fee, and if you need a light bulb changed or a drive to the chemotherapy, the volunteers come. But it's a self-contained based when it started up in the Back Bay area of Boston, I think in 1982. So this is only a virtual community. Is that correct?
This is a virtual community with a goal of creating real community. So it's a way of, so one of the things that, one of the elements of the genesis of all this was a survey that Stonewall did, in which it found 4 years ago, it was a New York City sponsored survey, and it found that that the LGBTQ population of New York was among the loneliest, poorest, and illest, and best educated in New York City. And so one of the things that we're hoping that this will do is penetrate the loneliness of and isolation that's experienced. And the goal is to be able to give LGBTQ seniors support through a variety of means, whether that's through visiting nurse service, whether that's through community activities, whether that's through home visits through the computer, whether that's through participation in things that they couldn't ordinarily participate in, a way to find out where others are going for events, to have companionship in a way that is hard for people who are isolated to achieve.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that it's correct that this is online only. The goal is to spur analog activity as well. So, you know, the sort of traditional interest groups and excursion groups, that'll all is all starting to form within this community, which is brand new because we've just gone live again after a period of redesign. We did an alpha test in the summer and fall with 56 users, and then completely redesigned the site based on the feedback that we got during the alpha. But it is absolutely intended to spur analog activity as well.
Okay, for those of us who are technologically challenged, when you use the phrase analog community...
To meet in real life.
Ah, okay. Like, hello, you know...
Okay. So the hope is that, you know, it will help people to meet, to work together on policy, or to work for the community, or just to meet and go do things that are enjoyable, whether that's seeing a play or a movie or a theater or an opening, or just going for a walk and having companionship, or going to the LGBT senior center. You know, just everything that you can think of is possible with a engaged community.
It's relational based. It's a relational based community. Obviously, a approach. To walk me through, if let's say I'm living, let's say in Queens, and I want to participate in this. I hear about this. I want to be part of this. How do I do that? Is there a, you know, I go to a website. I send a check. How do I do this? I'm just starting out. I hear about this. I want to be part of the Stonewall Village. Walk me through the process of what somebody would have to do.
So they would go to the site.
Which is?
StonewallVillageNYC.org.
Okay.
And hit the join. There's a landing page where they can, you know, see the different elements of the site. It's pretty complex. There are three major areas of the site with a lot of pages. It's sort of half resource and half engagement. So they would hit the join link. They get an email inviting them into the system, and then they come in. The membership page explains that we have a $20 a year membership, but you can pay either 20 or you can check a box not to pay anything. And that's all you have to do is check the box. Mm-hmm. Or you can buy one for $100 and sponsor four other people in. Or we have corporate as well. So Lyft just gave us $5,000 to sponsor 250 memberships.
Cool.
And then you create a profile. And once you've created a profile, you actually have VC video chat and Zoom at the touch of a button. So people can immediately start self-organizing without us at all. But there also is a portion of the site called Culture and Connection where, you know, we will mentor people into groups. Like we have one person who's just stepped forward, George, who wants to do a vlogging workshop with members. Mm-hmm. To learn how to do video blogs.
Right.
So part of what we're trying to do too is provide education about the issues and also education mostly in media and communication skills that will allow folks to either become ambassadors of the community and help onboard other folks or become advocates out in the world for this movement. Part of the idea is to give LGBT seniors a chance to take a lead in the community organizing and movement building.
Now, if I'm this guy who's in Queens and I really can't get out, I have some mobility issues, it's going to be a horrible day, it's going to be snowing or cold, I really need somebody to do some shopping. Is that part of, like, do I go on the portal through the portal and we'll connect with somebody who says, yes, I'm in the neighborhood, I can go to the supermarket if you give me what you want. I need a ride to my doctor's appointment and I just need help with that. Will those services also be offered as part of this program?
That is the plan. We have to build the membership first before those can activate.
Okay. That's
there will also be, there is a contact center. So there's also, people can reach the community through many ways, through the computer, through the phone, just by calling the contact center. As the community grows, there are going to be community ambassadors who will vet those kinds of questions and triage them, hopefully. And hopefully they'll be, this is an intergenerational community. So there's an emerging leadership council of young leaders who are also here to help support it. So unlike some villages that are more like, in a sense, like Shaker villages, because they're so confined to people who are aging,
right?
This is a village which is meant to be across generations.
Yeah, especially in the technology assistance. So once somebody joins, we have a welcome wagon process, because you could go on the site and find resources, but you would never really understand the power of the tool unless someone walks you through it. So those can happen on the phone, those can happen online, or they also happen live. We do them at senior centers and also here in our offices. So you kind of are partnered with an ambassador of friends from the beginning when you join. And if you can't get out of the house, part of what we're doing is a partnership with a group called CU Link, which is a tile-based mirror system of the internet for people who are cognitively impaired or technology averse. So we are actually working on a pilot program with them and some nurse service partners to explore how CU Link increases the efficacy of telemedicine and also allows deeper and more frequent contact with homebound folks. But also because we're going to be doing programming on the Zoom, people can also participate in programming through Zoom. So we're partnering with Kairos Dance out of Minneapolis, and they will do, they're working on dance and dementia. So they will do a live event at the Queen Senior Center for Gay Seniors, and we will broadcast that on Zoom. And because everyone has that tool, that is part of the tool, they can watch from home, or they can participate anonymously from home in the class, or they can actually throw themselves up as a tile on the screen and join the group.
Now, if I heard you correctly, the funding for the village, the Stonewall Village program, is through membership, private donations, corporate donations. Is that correct?
Most of the funding actually has come from the city of New York.
Ah, oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. And I think we just opened up the state pipeline this week. We're waiting to find out, but I believe that we did very well with our approach to the state as well. And the way we actually got the first city money was by pitching a non-geographic NORC, naturally occurring retirement community.
Right.
Basically saying, we have folks that are co-located in your NORC system who aren't coming forward to take advantage of the services because they don't feel welcome, or they're unsure that they're going to find anyone who has a shared experience with them.
And I think from the material you sent me, you're working with SAGE in New York, which is a major organization, correct?
Yes.
And SAGE stands for what, for the people who don't know what that is?
It's Service and Advocacy for GLBT Elders. And we basically, we don't create any services through this platform. We are referring to other groups who perform services. So one of the things that we're doing with this platform that is sort of the traditional function of a village is the credentialed vendors. That is how the Beacon Hill group started, was wanting to know, have a sort of vetted list of vendors that they could trust in their house. And so we are actually creating a directory of vendors who've been credentialed in LGBTQ competency or credentialed as gay-owned businesses. And part of the idea, when we talk about it with members, is that we are demanding a standard of respect and excellence from vendors, and then creating a market incentive to meet that standard. So as vendors want to come in and partner with us, we are actually referring them to the competency trainings at SAGE, or the there are some other groups that we work with as well. And so we're actually increasing the number of folks who are committing to become LGBTQ competent. And sometimes it's just, we have a group coming in from San Francisco who didn't have LGBT competency, which is just kind of nuts. But it really is about the protocols. If one client who's not gay picks on a gay client, what's the protocol? How do you handle that? And if there's no protocol in place, what almost always happens is that the LGBT client gets removed, even though they were being bullied, because systems just don't seem to be able to deal. They don't have the protocol in place to deal with it in a more effective way.
Do you have an ideal or a long-range goal for the number of people that you wish to serve? Is there a cap? I mean, or do you think this is just going to go evolving and you'll see how it goes? I mean, do you foresee a limit, an actual limit on the number of individuals you'll be able to take care of within this platform or within this program?
I don't know. We interviewed with a lot of folks who've done this before, and one of our favorite groups is the Bloomin' Place, which is up in the Bloomingdale district uptown. And they have like 600 special interest groups, and two ladies run it.
Yeah.
And they both work full time. I mean, they run it in their spare time. I think, it's all about the volunteer structure that you have in place. And also because we work with such a big community partner, we have over 50 organizations in our community partner network. We're not really not trying to do this work on our own. We're part of the idea is to avail people of resources and help them find their best housing and service outcomes, whatever those are, whether it's aging in place or moving into a new place. part of what we're doing is organizing the sector. So on April 11th, we have the Bricks and Mortar Brain Trust, where it's 80 invite-only architects and city planners and developers talking about micro-design, co-living, and house sharing as a potential strategy for LGBT senior housing. And we're doing it at WeLive, which is the new co-living space that WeWork has built down on Wall Street. And our board member, Matthias Holvisch, is actually the one who designed the prototype. So also bringing the sector together and talking about, I mean, a lot of the issues that we're dealing with are you know, universal evergreen issues for seniors in general. So a lot of the work that we're doing, especially in terms of strategies for creating more units in a building at less cost, apply to senior housing in general. So part of it's aimed at the senior population. Part of it's aimed at the rest of the intergenerational population to get them engaged as well. And this party last night was phenomenal in terms of how intergenerational it was. And, you know, people from the stage saying, I'm young, but I know I have to start thinking about this. And also in the LGBT community, there is a lot of ageism,
right?
Especially around looks and social status. So the more of this sort of intergenerational community organizing that we're doing, the better, I think.
I want to return to something that we've looked at in one or two other podcasts before, and you alluded to it right at the beginning. And now that we understand how this program is organized and how I can get into it, I'd like to return to something that I think is maybe at the heart of a larger issue, and I'd like both of you to kind of respond to it. I don't know whether it was Bruce or Paul who mentioned the fact that so many LGBTQ seniors are going, quote, your words, back into the closet, unquote. We ran across this when I spoke to somebody here who's working in this area in Philly, Heshi, who was very adamant about the need to create specialized housing, which they have in Philly, I think, because people would want to go into, you know, Shady Acres assisted living facility or a CCRC, a continuing care retirement community, and would want their partner, and that the staff at that particular institution has never really been oriented, trained, or they may come from an environment where this is totally alien to them. And so people are reluctant in the LGBTQ community to enter into these types of facilities, thus compounding the sense of isolation. So that's...
And that's a serious national problem.
It's right. That's what it... Could you, and so I want you to... How talk to me about how prevalent this is, because I don't think the majority of people in the general population are really aware of this.
Well, I think Paul may be able to address it more. I'll just add that I was speaking with a client last week in North Carolina who is very interested in what we're doing in New York because she has a relative who is LGBT in a community, and they've stopped accepting LGBT into the CCRC that she's in because they don't want a LGBT community there. So, you know, it seems to be a widespread practice to and fear, particularly among the elderly. But I'll let Paul speak to it in general. But to me, you know, this really goes to the heart of the value that can be created both by creating a grassroots movement that brings greater understanding and awareness both in the intergenerational portion of the community, because younger people are going to age and they need to understand the issues, and the broader community needs to understand what's happening so it can be broken down.
Yeah, there, and you know, there are lots of different kinds of discrimination, and it manifests in a lot of different ways. The Equal Rights Center did a study in 2015 of 10 cities across the country, three of which had sexual orientation in their housing rights laws. And they did the old redlining, pretending to be an older gay couple and then pretending to be an older straight couple. And in 48% of the time, the gay couple was given the wrong information, whether it was about availability or the application process or the cost or the amenities available. 48% of the time, the gay couple was given the wrong information. So, you know, knowing that that potential is out there, you kind of don't want to tease the tiger and bring on discrimination you might not otherwise suffer, especially if, you know, there's a place that seems like a match for you and you want to get in, but you don't want to hurt your chances and you don't know if identifying as LGBT will hurt your chances. Part of it also is just if there's no overt policy or protocol for welcoming LGBT folks, they're kind of going to assume invisibility and fit in with a crowd until they get some sense that there is a general support. And if that's not a topic of conversation, if it's not embraced by the administration of the organization, then it's not going to surface. There was a woman in the Halsted houses in Chicago. She said, you know, her partner of like 35 years had died. And she finally moved into the Halsted house. And she said, I you know, finally was in an environment of people with shared experience, and I was able to open up and start talking about my partner. And she said, I hadn't grieved for 8 years. Hmm.
So this sense of it's really just trying to find the right word, but it's almost the society, despite the perceived progress in society, the LGBT community, here you have this population of older adults who may be forced back, the image of what you said, Paul, of going back into the closet at the stage of life when they most need companionship, love, warmth, association with other human beings, it's a rather ironically cruel turn of events. So, I mean, how portable is this concept? In other words, are you getting contacts? I seem to sense that you may be from other communities around the United States or North America, of seeing if what you're doing is portable, that I can bring it to this city or that city. Are you getting that type of communication?
We get a lot of people when they hear about this saying, can we do this in Chicago, in San Francisco? I hear it all the time, particularly through LGBT members within the Life Planning Network who are professionals. And so, you know, but we basically want to prove it out here and make this a model, and then we'll see, you know. This is a big enough bear in itself, obviously, and but my gut says that this will work, in a way that we can't even begin to picture yet.
And I think that the key is, so when we started 5 years ago, there we went looking for data on the LGBTQ senior population to sort of build a market profile of who we're going to try to build for, and there was no data at all because government basically doesn't provide an opportunity to self-identify at the point of service. So there really is no data on this group of folks. So we created this partner network. We did this survey. It was actually in 2017. We needed 500 responses. We got 966. And the data is very well qualified and also very telling. And so part of what the village is doing is collecting the data on the back end without identifying anybody. So it's headless data, but every single choice and preference and need that's expressed by the way people traffic the site is captured and aggregated. So we're constantly building this very accurate market profile of whom we're trying to serve. And that, you know, I think if other cities do that, then they probably will be successful in trying to do this model. I mean, we had 65% white male in our survey, and it's still, the poverty was so far below what the general population is. The mental illness, 25% of the survey have a psychiatric diagnosis. The multiple major illnesses, the sort of morbidity quotient is much higher. And then we didn't even really reach the people with trans experience. We got 5% participation. People thought that was amazing. And we were just like, that's not representative of the group. So a lot of what we've been doing is really building out our trans outreach. And so there are certain things, like in city housing, if you use New York City money and the rent subsidies, the SARA program, then you have to have 1/3 of the people that come into your new affordable housing building direct from the shelters. People with trans experience do not use the shelters. And LGBT people don't really use the shelters very much. So already 30% of the apartments you're building are not going to be available to those folks. And then there's so many people in this cohort, especially in New York City, of course, who are in the entertainment industries or the service professions, who never had W-2s, which makes a very difficult affordable housing application if you don't have W-2s. So part of it is also just surfacing the strategies that we're going to have to create just to bring people up to speed with where everybody else is at when they enter a lottery where there's 900 people to one for, you know, ratio to units available.
So let me, before we run out of time, Paul, if somebody's listening to this or hears this eventually and they want some more information, they want to contact either the two of you, who do they talk to? How do they contact you?
I think the best way is through the village. If they go to stonewallvillagenyc.org.
And that'll get them into communication with you guys.
Yeah, because nobody comes into the community without onboarding. So,
and if they want, they can reach out through that. They can send a message through stonewallvillagenyc.org. That's one way. If anyone wants to contact me about the platform, they can just, I'm happy to give out my phone number, 917-363-1460, or they can email me at at bfrankel@myredstring.com.
At myredstring.com.
Right. One thing that I just wanted to mention, which just, I don't know how much time, but, I thought it would be of interest for your listeners, is that CU-Link, the tile-based system that overlays us for people who have cognitive impairment, that system has been tested for the last 4 years in England with 400 Holocaust survivors, average age 85, and after 4 years, 75% of them are still using the system.
Wow.
So that shows you it can be, the issues of technology can be overcome.
Oh, yes, yes, especially when the need is there and the desire is there, which obviously you're finding that it is. So Bruce Frankel and Paul Nagel, thank you very much. just congratulations on all this progress you've made, and you guys are right. You have a lot of work ahead of you, but congratulations. You're going to save some lives, and that's not rabbinic hyperbole. You will save some lives.
Thank you, Rabbi.
So thank you. Take care. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. To all of you, I want to thank you again for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Again, we welcome your comments to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com and invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And our producer, we give thanks to Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you for listening. Tudah and Shalom.